January 22nd, 2009, and we are going to, we carried over Senate Bill 25, so we're going to continue with that to finish that up, and then we'll go into Senate Bill 96 and 97. So with that, we had already heard from President Courtney and Senator Rosenbaum, so let us continue with Roy Orr from the Oregon State Hospital. These two up and then these two. Because these probably aren't here. Gina's not here. Welcome. And this is a subcommittee at this point in time until we get a quorum, and then we'll be in a full committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roy Orr. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 25 and the minor change in the Dash 1 amendment. This bill was drafted at the direction of the Interim Joint Patient Care Oversight Committee, as we heard Tuesday, on behalf of the state hospital. Oregon State Hospital worked closely with committee leadership and representatives from consumer and advocacy organizations to reach language that we believe will best serve the patients at the state hospital. All involved shared a common vision of a board that included a broad cross-section of legislators, consumers of mental health services, non-OSH mental health service providers, advocates, family members, and members of the general public. The intent is that advisory board would meet monthly to constructively critique and actively participate in the review of the state hospital's administrative and clinical operations, and to provide important input into establishing goals and priorities for all programs. We believe this board will help improve the quality of care that patients receive and improve the safety of patients and staff. You may find a difference of opinions as to the merits of a board that is advisory in nature versus a board with greater authority. Ultimately, the individuals who participated in the development of this concept felt comfortable with a board that was advisory with annual reporting to the appropriate committee of the Legislative Assembly. In essence, the legislation before you establishes the foundation upon which people from diverse backgrounds and differing perspectives can build relationships based on one common goal: the patient's efficient and successful recovery. I'd also like to mention there's a fiscal impact related to this legislation. The funding in the fiscal impact is for the travel costs associated with members of the advisory board. Section 1, subsection 8, requires OSH to reimburse individuals for their costs associated with their travel. We think it's important to have their travel costs covered. We've not included any additional staffing costs because internal ad hoc committees will be phased out and existing staff will be redeployed to serve this board. OSH will cover these costs from the operating budget, ultimately approved by the 09 legislature. As the current superintendent, I view the creation of this board as a commitment to move the Oregon State Hospital beyond the mere presentation of information, often referred to as transparency. I view it as the beginning of our commitment to the public to have a diverse, representative group join Oregon State Hospital leadership in setting goals and monitoring our progress toward becoming a world-class organization. I thank you and would be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Are there questions right now? We may have questions later if you don't mind sticking around until we have the rest of the panel talk. All right, with no questions, we will, you can go ahead and sit. We'll call up Megan Cahy and Megan Moyer. If you two would come on up.
Sources to wherever it is. It makes sense that it's supposed to be at the hospital right there. I mean, don't tell my skin situation. Okay. Guys, get together on page for it. Okay.
Go ahead.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 25. My name is Megan Cahay. I'm Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon. Excuse me for my froggy voice, it's early. Mental Health America of Oregon was formerly the Mental Health Association of Oregon. I have been a mental health consumer for the past 30-some-odd years. I've been hospitalized over 100 times, and I'm grateful to be living in recovery and wellness now for the past 10 years. And for the past 1.5 years, I've been working full-time in the capacity where I'm able to give back to my community and my peers. And I'm very happy to be able to do that. And in my role, I'm very much invested in the wellness and recovery of my peers and very concerned about the well-being of my peers that are in the Oregon State Hospital. I was part of the work group that worked with Mr. Orr and others on the concept of the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. And I am satisfied with the way that it has come about to become Senate Bill 25. In particular, I'm very happy to see that the makeup of the board includes mental health consumers and members of the advocacy community. And also former mental state hospital patients. So my one request would be that when leadership roles are assigned by the governor's office and the Department of Human Services leadership, that mental health consumers being well considered and taken into consideration for being given leadership positions as members of the advisory board. It's very important, I think, that the idea of consumer voice be taken as part of this advisory board, and that the advisory board be part of the way that we bring about the culture of hope for the hospital. We all want transformation and reform and a better place for the people at the Oregon State Hospital, and I believe that this advisory board can be an important instrument to bring this about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan, very much. Any questions? Megan Martin.
Chair Mama Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. We represent the frontline work, many of the frontline workers at the Salem Oregon State Hospital facility. And I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 25 and to ask for your support for the -2 amendment, which would add 2 seats to this advisory board. One individual from the largest employee represented union, which is SEIU, and one from the second largest employee represented union, which is AFSCME. Our desire for this amendment is to continue our participation in the process of improving the quality of care at the state hospital. Our workers strongly believe that we can be a positive voice and a positive perspective in this process, and a unique and important perspective in conversations about how conditions and treatment models can improve the care in the hospital. Our intention is not to usurp the labor management process and have no intention of bringing labor management related issues. We fully understand the purpose of this advisory board, and our intentions and desires to participate are out of a desire to be a positive voice and a positive perspective in this board, so that it might be able to bring the more fully thought out recommendations, having perspectives that can inform in a new way the discussion that they will be bringing forward. As
Ms. Moyer, what specific workers are under SEIU and what specific workers are under AFSCME?
SEIU represents, and there are many categories, so I'm sure I'm going to miss, probably the largest is the mental health therapists. They're the frontline staff worker, and there are others. We also have psychologists, AFSCME, and they can speak for themselves. I don't want to miss anyone. They have the nurses and the doctors. I'm sure they'd be, if I'm incorrect, but primarily that's kind of the break.
Great. Thank you very much. At this point, if no discussion, we will continue with the rest of the panel, and then we'll discuss the merits of the amendments.
We do have a member here to speak on the amendment.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's thank you, Bob Jundeff and Mary Botkin.
Control yourself.
We flipped a coin. I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And we looked at the bill, and we think this bill, by the way, is a great idea. I want to reiterate the goals, at least from our perspective of what we see as the goals for this committee and for the future of the Oregon State Hospital. Our goals are to improve patient care, to create an environment where respect and safety are the mainstream, both for the clients as well as for the employees, and where we can offer some reasonable hope for recovery for our clients and support for a mainstream placement of our clients in the community, and to do what needs to happen to make that happen. We have suggested, and I've been working with your committee administrator, we're suggesting that possibly 3 bargaining unit members should be included on the board, and the 3 bargaining unit members would be from each of the major bargaining units, one from the doctor's local, one from the nurse's local, and one from the direct care staff local. And I think the argument that we would make is that each one of those individuals needs to be there, not because they're a union member, but because they work in the hospital and they bring a unique perspective to the challenges that they face and the individuals face, both the clients and the staff, every day in that environment. And, you know, doctors bring a perspective that is different than nurses, and nurses different than direct care staff. None is more important than the other, and they all have a role to play, and I think it's a productive role. But what we have to remind everybody is the goal is to make OSH a better place. It's to make it a place that people do not fear, but rather see as a placement for recovery and stabilization and discharge. And right now, I don't think a lot of people see it that way. And that's a challenge we need to take on, and the advisory board can take on. And I think that it makes sense for us to sort of proceed forward with the idea that we're partners in the solution, not adversaries in a problem.
Ms. Botkin, can you refer to the bill. Do you have that in front of you?
I do.
Bill 25. And so you wanted, you didn't, your concept is not to add more like Amendment 2 does, but to, so who would you replace on this?
Well, I didn't realize I was replacing somebody when I suggested my, when I made my suggestion, and I apologize, Madam Chair, for this. I suggested that the three healthcare professionals be a doctor, a nurse, and a direct care staff person working at the hospital. I now have been led to believe that those were placements for outside medical professionals. I did not understand that, and again, I apologize. I know that the President of the Senate does not want this to be a 30-member board, and I can see that expanding the board is problematic. But I would suggest that at some level we either need to insert that those three individuals in sub B, or we need to add another couple of members for sub B. Because I think not including medical staff that work there and have a career of long-term experience of working in that environment is a mistake. And certainly our doctors and nurses would, I mean, we would facilitate their having a voice at that, with this board, but I think being a member of the board offers a perspective ongoing. And then the other change that we would make is that we would treat state employees in a non-reimbursable way so that you take out the cost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because if there's travel expenses, as crass as it may sound, I mean, the union will make arrangements to pay for their travel expenses if it's necessary.
All right. Okay, well, even with the new amendment, we won't be doing anything with this bill today, and so we would need to have a fiscal on it. But any questions? Okay, yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having diverse representation is good, but my reflection is, and maybe might be some response to it, is that If we're dealing with clinical issues and treatment and how do we improve outcomes for the patients, not just the environment, but the actual clinical treatment, it occurs to me that three clinical professionals is low, that there should be more representation from the professional side, but I understand and certainly support a broad representation, but it seems to me that three out of what could be a 13-member board is low.
And again, I wasn't part of the task force, and we might want Roy to come back up to state the intent again of this advisory committee. I'm used to governing boards. I think advisory boards is very different. Governing boards are definitely from the community, and they and that's for regular hospitals. For the state hospital, it's a little different. Go ahead. Introduce yourself again for the record.
For the record, I'm Roy Orr, Superintendent, Oregon State Hospital. Madam Chair, members of the committee, like you, that's my experience too, governing boards. And this is a slightly different animal in state government to create one that's advisory in nature. But I believe it's the appropriate way for us to go, given the many external interests that we have in the ongoing operation of the hospital, both within the mental health community and the general public, and those who are close to the patients, if not directly related to the patients there, and the historical absence of their having a voice and a presence at the table when the hospital is reviewing its operations and setting its goals and its priorities going forward. And therein lies the intent of this bill to, as I said in my earlier testimony, move beyond the mere presentation of information, which we now call transparency, opening up the organization for all to see, but invite these various publics in to sit down and look at the constraints we have to operate within, regulatory, legal, fiscal, and help us establish priorities and monitor progress toward those goals. We did, in the formative stages, consider the possibility of having staff participate, and we didn't speak to union representation specifically, but staff participate in holding positions on this advisory board. And again, while we're maybe comparing apples to oranges here, comparing this advisory board to boards that both you, Madam Chair, and I are more familiar with elsewhere, it is unusual to have staff members of a hospital serve on a board. And we, who were involved in the conceptual planning of this legislation that's now become Senate Bill 25, determined that the most appropriate interaction for our staff, physicians, nurses, and other staff at all levels, was in the various committees that we speak to in Section 4 of this bill, ad hoc committees that the board itself would identify the need for, whether it's quality or it's cultural change or safety or whatever those committees might be, that's where staff will interact. And absent in this discussion to this point has been the expectation that staff will interact significantly with this advisory board. Our conversations so far have sounded like being on this board is the only way to have a voice, and I personally don't believe that's the case at all. I believe it will be frequent, if not every meeting, presentations from members of our staff in terms of educational opportunities, which again I'm very familiar with from my past board experiences. And as I said, I believe at the committee levels, based on the priorities of this advisory board, the committee levels, as Section 4 says, there will be two members of the board and the rest of the members will not be board members. They will be drawn additionally from the community or from the hospital staff. So I'll stop at that point, but I think there's an abundance of opportunities for staff interaction and okay. staff input to this process.
That's clarified. Yes, Senator Morissette.
I'm not quite sure what you're saying about the participation of union members on the advisory board. Would you please clarify? Do you see any detrimental participation, or is it a help or hindrance to have members of the union?
I was speaking, Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was speaking to staff in a generic sense,
okay.
not unions per se. We don't oppose union participation. And Mary, I think, referred to them as partners in the solution,
yes.
And indeed they have been and are, irrespective of what we create in this Senate Bill 25. What I'm not in favor of is diluting our opportunity to bring an external audience in to scrutinize our work. I'm not in favor of growing this board, not necessarily to 30, but even 13 gives me some anxiety about our ability, those of you who've served on boards, and I'm sure people on this committee have, every couple of members you add to a board, it's almost exponentially more difficult to schedule meetings. So I'm very concerned about adding to the 11, and I'm even more concerned about the dilutive effect, back to the intent, Madam Chair, of our wanting an external audience that was broadly outlined in this Senate bill to participate with us at the hospital. More directly to your question, Senator Morissette, I'm not opposed to union participation. I'm opposed to diluting the external scrutiny and participation in this process, and I'm opposed to increasing the size of the board.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Chair Munz Anderson. Looking through this, it appears to me that you've well covered advocates for patients, families, interaction with the community mm-hmm. on this board. And you have some representation of a professional, but not necessarily from the hospital. My experience may be quite different than yours as far as, and these are governing boards, as you came from a governing board at Mackenzie Willamette. My experience is quite different. Senator Morris's may be different than mine also, although I think it probably isn't. And that is that these boards have a significant number of their members who are from the staff. You usually have a chief of medicine, chief of surgery, and the one who really runs the show, the chief of nursing there. And they can give a sense of reality to some of the discussions that occur because they're right there at the board level. The patients can give you a sense of reality. They can give you a little different sense when you actually have the staff there. I will admit that quite often the chief operating officer sometimes doesn't like to hear that reality. And you've probably had it a few times in your discussions at the Mackenzie Willamette. But it makes a more open and better discussion. This is a different animal. It's an advisory board, but it could someday become a governing board. And the decision was made not to make it a governing board this time, but it could change. So I think this is a real issue, and this isn't about union representation necessarily. It's about staff representation and leadership in that staff having a place on the board. I've also been on commissions of 15 and 19 and 21, and they become impossible to deal with. They really do. I think 11 is probably about as big as you want to go, maybe 13, that's even questionable. But I think there's room within those 11 here to make some shifts that would bring those on board. And one spot I see it is, I'm not suggesting this as what to do, but something we can discuss, the three professionals may need to be drawn from the staff. And you'd set it up that way. So this wouldn't enlarge it. You still have three healthcare professionals from advising the board, but they'd be from within the staff, and that would get them there without enlarging the size of the board. So I understand your concerns, I think. I think the board is a little different than most, but this is a different hospital, too, mm-hmm. and has some special needs as far as that board's concerned. Because with the exception of a lack of staff support here, I don't see any real problem with the board's makeup right now. But I think those three professionals probably should come from the staff. And that would be my suggestion. But we can look at that more carefully at a later time.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also echo Senator Bates' comment. My experience in the governing boards that I serve today in healthcare, absent that internal perspective from the physicians and the staff, we would not be nearly as effective. And granted, again, it's a governing board situation, but your focus is exactly the same. Your focus is on patient safety, outcomes, and quality improvement. Absolutely, right down the line. And so the alignment of the goals are all the same, and if you didn't have that internal perspective, you would be lost. And so I think three is probably not on the strong side, but to have that internal professional participation, I think, would be vital.
I'm just trying to read who would be, the governor would be appointing these people, and these usually come with a recommendation from the hospital. So, all right. Any further questions for, yes?
I might just offer, while we're talking about composition, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that Senate Bill 364 requires us to have 20% consumer participation in this board. So, as you contemplate the eventual composition. And I appreciate Senator Morse's and Senator Bates' comments about participation of professionals. Again, it's a little bit of an apples and oranges sort of thing in that most medical staffs are not employed medical staffs, and therefore you have a chief of staff, as I'm used to, who's representative of the independent practitioners on your staff as a member and a full voting member of the board. Certainly, we'll have our chief medical officer present for all board meetings. We're a little different animal again in that regard.
I certainly don't resist the idea of having more participation of professionals or even a slot for professionals for that reason as members of the advisory board.
I'm not familiar with Senate Bill 364 of 2009.
Of the previous, I'm sorry.
Oh, 2007. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Bob Junedeff.
Thank you, Chair Monza Anderson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. You've seen me here before as Director of Oregon Advocacy Center, and that's because we changed our name. So everything else is the same.
So what's the name again?
Disability Rights Oregon.
Disability Rights Oregon.
And we've gone through, yes, a rebranding process and trying to find a name that better conveys what we do. And we have a new logo, and we can talk about what it means, if you like, at a later time. But in our history as Oregon Advocacy Center, and to this day we've advocated at the state hospital for now over 20 years. We have outreach workers at the state hospital every week. I'm sure you know that we've engaged in legal action with the state hospital numerous times over the years. We understand the conditions at the hospital. We're there constantly. In talking with advocates during the last session and watching the proceedings of the Joint Committee dealing with the state hospital, we began to have discussions about perhaps the need for more consistent, knowledgeable oversight of the facility. And we brought those questions to state folks and to Superintendent Orr, and started to have the discussion about maybe what we need is a board. We did some research. We found that in the equivalent of the state hospital in Toronto, that they established a governing board for that facility, and that by all reports, this is a very successful board. And the literature around it showed that by bringing in outside perspectives, by having individuals there who represented both professions and community members and consumers and families, that the hospital had the very type of support that boards of directors bring to a facility, both in terms of expertise, knowledge, reaction, a good sounding board for what's going on, and also as a messenger to policymakers and funders in terms of what are the needs of the facility. We also found similar structures in other states. I was particularly interested to note an article last year about a facility in New Jersey that had gone without the governor appointing members to its advisory board for a couple of years, and that was pinned or is explained as one of the reasons that they had a decrease in the conditions and services of that facility because it had been neglected. No one was listening and no one was watching. I believe that this concept was appealing to the interim committee because Senator Courtney, Representative Rosenbaum, noted that this is a very complex matter running a large facility, and it's very hard as a legislator to really keep a handle on it and know what's going on. And if you have a board that's there constantly, it's knowledgeable about the facility, they can bring information to you that is unbiased, doesn't have a particular interest, doesn't have particular allegiance to one side or another, and the various interests that play a part in a facility's operation. And in an entire system of care, because as we know, the state hospital is part of a broad system of care. So we'd have a group of people who, like any governing board, that has the sole responsibility to be loyal and supportive of that institution. And I can tell you, as the director of a nonprofit, and having been the director for a nonprofit for over 20 years, I rely upon my board to do just that. And when my board members sit with me, I know that they're sitting there in order to see that the best interests of Disability Rights Oregon and our clients are served. They're not there to represent various interests or that might have a stake in what we do. They're there when they sit there to assure that we're the best that we can be and that we have the resources that we need in order to be the best that we can be. And that's what we saw this board as being. I hadn't seen these amendments until I got to this hearing this morning, and so it's difficult for me to give you a complete sense of that. But as I noted in my testimony, our major concern is that whoever sits on the board is there to support the running of the operation, to make sure that's as good as it can be, to make sure that the information that you get and that the information that DHS gets and the governor gets about what's going on at that hospital is accurate and sound. And I think that should be our lodestar in terms of who we decide is an appropriate membership for the board. I'm reminded of testimony that we heard over the course of the hearings on the Joint Committee on the State Hospital. And I think if you look at those proceedings, that there were various interests involved who had very different perspectives. And I think that was one of the things that the committee, again, struggled with, was having to juggle various perspectives and interests that came before them. My feeling is that this particular board is going to have voting members. It's designed to have voting members, and it's designed to include as many people as possible who will come to meetings regularly, who will participate on an ongoing basis, and that is to be encouraged. But in terms of their voting, I think where that will become important will be when they vote on various reports and information that will come to you and will reflect a broad consensus of opinion, and will also approve and support priorities, as were mentioned earlier, for OSH to move forward. And so that's going to be a key difference between who is involved and who gets to vote. And so I would also keep that in mind in thinking about that who should be members of the board. That having been said, I think there's broad support for this bill. I think we see it as necessary. And I believe that... the last thing I'd say is that the hospital, of course, some folks think that when you get in government services, there's no competition anymore, but there's fierce competition, as you know, for resources. And for you to make decisions about where resources are needed, it's absolutely essential for you to have accurate information. And I think that I heard over and over again from legislators when they were faced with the specter of the Department of Justice coming into Oregon and taking over the hospital, folks said, I just didn't know how bad it was. I didn't know that we were at that point. But I can tell you that we have been at that point for a long time, and the fact that we didn't really appreciate that is something that I think a board of this kind can address.
Thank you. With that, there are two members that were signed up. Thank you, panel, very, very, very much. There were three people from last Wednesday. Gina Nickel, do you want to testify today? And then Randy Davis and Marianne Grieve. Those are the only other people that were on. They're not here. Okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. One of the goals of this committee is to improve patient safety and the quality of care. We would ask that either a representative of the local mental health authority, a county commissioner, or a community mental health program director be put on this board. And the reason is one of the things that we do when somebody gets admitted to the hospital is we start transition planning back to the community immediately. That's between the hospital and the community. to plan for transitioning, and there's no voice at the table to speak about that, and we feel that we need to underscore how important that is for patient care, for people to realize that their time in the hospital should be short, and they should be planning to get back out in the community.
Have you drafted an amendment?
We have not. We await your orders. We're trying to be team players here.
I think that since the advisory committee worked so hard on this, and they were privy probably to a whole lot more information than we are receiving today, Senator Bates has volunteered to work with the unions and on an amendment, and if you would take that into account too. I think the key is here we do not want to make this board huge at this point in time. And if everybody's going to come to the table and say we want to be on this advisory committee, I think it behooves us to take a real close look and have it work with what is here. And I'm not saying whether we should expand it or not, but this is a beginning, a very beginning, and I'm very concerned that it's going to get too big. So we want to watch that. Yes.
Madam Chair, I want to make sure I get direction from you. My sense is we do not enlarge the number of members. We stay with 13.
11.
11, I'm sorry. We stay with 11. And that we work within that number to change some of the representation and bring it back to you.
Yeah, I'm not committed to staying to 11 because I haven't looked at who would be
taken off if we might add anyone else.
So yeah.
My hope is we can stay at 11 and fulfill the needs of everyone in this room.
Yeah.
And I would also say that my memory of this from Senator Courtney and Senator Rosenbaum was that they felt that some movement within this board was appropriate. They weren't absolutely set in stone how they felt.
And they did say that it wasn't really complete because they were running into a timeline when a piece of legislation had to be drafted. So
we'll get back to you within a week?
Yeah, that would be great.
Appropriate?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I would just also remind you about Senate Bill 364. I would have someone check to make sure about the 20% consumer representation at this board.
The idea is being floated rapidly here would more than satisfy that requirement.
Great.
Thank you.
And this may not be meet the needs of Senate Bill 324.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It'd be a different thing. It's hard to know.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 25, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96, and if I can have the witness registration. Great. All right.
It doesn't. It just doesn't change that.
I'll bring it to
you. Well, no. I mean, if you try to mess with that,
okay, Jim.
Yeah.
And do you want someone else to come up with you, or you'll start the show?
I think I'll just start it.
We'll get together real quick.
Sounds okay.
Colleagues, as you know, part of our charge is to deal with Veterans Affairs issues, and this we're going to be dealing with two bills regarding Veterans Affairs, and I'm very excited about this issue. It's an issue that I felt that we needed a separate committee for since I've been in the Senate, and I was very happy when the President decided to add this as a part of the Senate. Thank you, Mr. Russell.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, and professional staff. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I am the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 96, which makes consistent the term veteran in statute using the definition that's currently provided in ORS 408-225. I believe my written testimony is before the committee. And as part of that, you will notice that there are currently six definitions of veteran in statute. Also, in Article 11, Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution, there is a definition for war veteran for the purposes of the Department Home Loan Program. The variety of definitions has caused confusion regarding just what a veteran is and is not. Senate Bill 96 defines veteran as stated in ORS 408225 so that there is one definition that is consistent in statute. This bill does not affect the constitutional definition of war veteran and the War Veteran Fund. The department believes it's important to have consistency in defining veteran in statute so that there is no confusion as to who is eligible for which programs. Senate Bill 96 cleans up the statutes by providing a definition that has the broadest application. I'd like to thank the committee and the chair for the consideration for this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm good with it.
Is there any opposition to this?
I've heard of no opposition, Chair.
All right. Is there any discussion from the committee?
I'd like to move the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 96, and I'll open the work session. Can we do that, the work session?
Yeah, it's scheduled.
Work session on Senate Bill 96.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 96 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 96 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And I'll go ahead and I'll carry this bill. All right. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 96, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 97. And the witness registration, is that you again, Mr. Willis?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, professional staff, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 97, which is a simple housekeeping bill that allows the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to purchase loan cancellation life insurance for its home loan clients. The loan cancellation life insurance is an insurance that covers mortgage payments in the event of the death of the borrower. Under current statute, the Department of Administrative Services must procure the loan cancellation life insurance for ODVA. And I would point out, although it's not part of my written testimony, that that authority can be delegated from the Department of Administrative Services to the Department of Veterans Affairs. That is, in fact, in practice what has been happening for at least the past 10 years. So as a result, we would like to simplify the process by allowing ODVA to purchase its own loan cancellation life insurance and offer it to its clients. In practice, ODVA already does purchase this insurance, and this bill would codify that practice. The Department of Administrative Services does not object to this measure. Again, this is a simple housekeeping measure that will streamline the process of offering loan cancellation life insurance to our clients. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
This sounds too logical and simple and linear for us to be dealing with, Madam Chair. But
that was too easy.
You know, we don't do easy things, Jim. You know,
we do them, but we make them hard.
Okay, that's true.
We'll make them easy.
Madam Chair, I just have a quick question, if I could. And this is not really, it's not really pertinent to this. I don't see any problem with this. Which veterans qualify for this loan cancellation insurance? Is any veteran living in the state, or is only veterans who entered the service from the state of Oregon? And is this a lower rate for those veterans?
Okay, Senator Bates, Chair Mona Sanderson, the veterans that qualify for our home loan programs are veterans who can demonstrate that they are a resident of the state of Oregon, that this loan will fund their primary residence. They must live in this residence, and they must, of course, serve honorably.
And the last part of that question was, do they get a reduced rate for this insurance? Some of this insurance can be fairly expensive for people.
This rate is predicated on age of the person at time of purchase. Against the market, we're finding that our LCLI insurance is very reasonably set. We have seen many, many cases where a family, through a tragic, unexpected death of the borrower, was able to keep their home, of course, because it was paid off through the LCLI insurance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I mixed up my witness registration sheets, and we passed a bill where there were three other people who wanted to testify, but we will call them up after we, there is no one else to testify on Senate Bill 97. Is there any further discussion? With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 97, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 97.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 97 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 97 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. Who's the veteran on the committee?
I'm one. Am I the only one? I am. Vietnam vet. Okay.
Let's you start it out, and then we'll start letting everyone else do it. With that, Senator Bates will...
Sure, give him the easy one.
I know.
Absolutely. We're nice to the chair, she'd do it for you, too.
Exactly. All right. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 97, and I'm going to take the authority to call Kevin O'Reilly, Joseph Riley, is it Riley, and Doug Michael, please come forward. I want your testimony, even though we've already passed the bill.
Yeah. Careful what you say. If you don't lose the bill now.
Would you like to start?
You go ahead.
Sorry, thank you. Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I represent the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and we support the bill that you just passed.
Thank you very much.
I don't think I need to say much more.
All right, thank you.
Oh,
and when did you serve, and where did you serve?
In 1976-77 in Germany with an artillery unit.
All right. Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you.
Chair, my name is Anderson and committee. My name is Doug McElvin. I'm the manager of the Washington County Veterans Office, and I thank you for forwarding the bills you've just considered. But I also want to thank you for the monies that the legislature supplies to the Washington County Veterans Unit, our office of eight people. In the last quarter, you gave us $38,000. We track the federal compensation pension flowing into our county to the veterans who've come through our office. For the last quarter, the federal monies paid to our veterans working with our office was over $5 million for those 90 days. And for the retro payments for veterans who whose awards have just been granted, largely through appeals for the last 90 days, is over $1.8 million. And we think that's a huge return on the $38,000 that you've given to us. And we view that as a stimulus package to Washington County, federal stimulus package, particularly in view of Intel laying off 1,000 people yesterday. So we simply thank you very much for your support of the County Veterans Services Offices and the monies passed to us through ODVA. We thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And where did you serve?
I was an aircraft maintenance officer in the Air Force from 1968 to 72 in the States and Korea.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
They are prepared to give a brief presentation.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And is Joseph Riley here?
Joseph left as soon as you passed the bill.
Okay. Oh, all right. Well, if you see him, send him my regrets that I wasn't on top of it.
Thank you.
All right. Now, I think that Jim Willis has just a brief presentation on Veterans Affairs, B-1. before we go to our next informational hearing on the Oregon Health Fund Board.
Chair Moses Anderson, members of the committee, I believe the brief presentation that you've made reference to is the agency overview that talks about the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Yes.
Okay. Again, I believe you have a handout that will cover this, so I don't like to read from PowerPoints or from written documents, so I'm going to read or I'm going to comment between the lines, if you will. This last interim period, the members of my staff and I met to discuss where we were operationally in our day-to-day work and where we needed to go strategically for the future. One of the things that we did that I believe is very important is we rewrote our mission statement. And in rewriting it, the one thing I'd like to point out is that it says that with the support of our citizens. And it simply means that the citizens of Oregon see as a matter of public policy the care and respectful treatment of veterans and their families who have served our nation. We as a department very much respect that, and we also respect the fact that our citizens have been supportive of both houses of our legislature in passing needed legislation to provide very much needed services to our veterans. I will tell you that our department, again, through the legislative process, was created before World War II was even over. In 1944, this body recognized the need to serve the veterans coming home from that war. And in World War II, over 16 million Americans were in uniform, men and women. And when they came home, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was established in 1945 and primarily to create a veteran home loan program so that these folks could get on with their lives, on with their employment, and on with their education. Since that time, our department has expanded in a number of different ways. In addition to our claims and counseling offices in Salem and Portland, we also work hand-in-hand with the county veteran service officers and with service officers who are representatives of the major veterans organizations such as the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Purple Heart, Disabled American Veterans, and others. In addition to, again, our home loans, we have a conservatorship program. And I'll just go through very quickly some of the things that we do. The conservatorship program, and sometimes years ago it might have been referred to as a guardianship, is a program that has a fiduciary responsibility to care for veterans who have been court-identified as persons who cannot manage their own finances. We sometimes refer to them as protected persons. We currently have 180 of that kind of client. We deal with them on a daily basis through trust officers and assistant trust officers who are members of our conservatorship unit. We also work hand-in-hand with field examiners from the federal VA who work to inspect and identify the processes that are in place. That program is audited regularly, as are all of our fiduciary programs throughout the department. Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a special concern about traumatic brain injury that has occurred, and I know that the Veterans Administration has not always recognized it as such. Are you dealing directly with those individuals that have, and are you able to identify those people?
Senator Morsett, Chair Mona Sanderson, you raise an issue very important, so let me just discuss it briefly. When we first went to war in Iraq and later in Afghanistan, there was not an automatic screening process through the Department of Defense for returning war veterans in that theater of operation. There is now. When you come back from those theaters, you are screened for both traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder so that treatment can be provided, so that claims can be filed, and appropriate compensation and health regimens can be undertaken. So what we're doing for those veterans that are in the gap that you're talking about is conducting outreach programs, starting clear down at the county level, through employees that work for me, and also through specialists at the federal government, so that these screenings can occur and we can get the treatment for those who fell through the system before the recognition of these very high number of veterans who were being impacted by these concussive explosions and vehicle-borne explosive devices. So I believe, Senator, we're doing a good job of doing the outreach. I will tell you, quite frankly, we have not found them all.
Yeah.
And I believe we're going to deal with this issue of traumatic brain injury and the current group of post-traumatic stress disorder for a number of decades to come. The issue is, are we going to be funded, and when I say that, I'm talking about at the federal level, appropriately for the treatment that these folks need, either as outpatients or actual hospitalization for injuries that need to be treated. We're going to constantly talk to our congressional delegation about the need for the appropriate funding, and I'm encouraged by the appointment of Secretary Shinseki as the new Director of Veterans Affairs at the federal level. I can tell you that as a general officer, he was chief of staff of the Army, but more importantly, General Shinseki was a company grade officer leading combat infantrymen in Vietnam when he was in fact wounded and a portion of his foot was lost. He knows the VA system from inside, and he knows how to take care of the people who have been impacted by war and need those services. Perhaps the greatest compliment that can be paid to a combat leader is from the infantrymen, or sometimes called the grunts, that are actually getting the work done, and they feel very strongly about his leadership ability. And I will assure you this, that the Department of Veterans Affairs at the federal level is the second largest agency in all of federal government. So it's really important to have someone that understands how to lead a large agency to administer it. Having been the former chief of staff of the United States Army, I think General Shinseki understands that, and now as secretary will be a good partner for all of us at the state level and down to and including our county veteran service folks. I'm encouraged, and I think we're going to do well, especially because he'll understand the importance of identifying and treating traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Thank you.
Okay, I probably have made it pretty clear that we welcome and encourage and try to promote the best possible relationship between the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, our department, and the county Veterans Service people. I'm amazed when I go to national meetings and hear the bickering that is occurring between regional offices of the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, the healthcare system, the state directors and some of their staff, and then some of the county workers. I can assure you that in Oregon, our relationship with the three branches of the federal government, which is, of course, Memorial Affairs or Cemetery Affairs, the Veterans Benefit Administration, and the healthcare, is top of the line. We speak to each other on a regular basis. We're briefed by them. We brief them, and the county veteran service people and us are in very close association. One of the tenets of our state that I'm most proud of is this. With our rural, urban, suburban, and metro environments, one of our goals is to make sure that no veteran suffers from quality of service by their choice of geographic residence. So, if they're living in Monument, Oregon, I want to know that they're very close to a federally accredited service officer that can meet their needs, whether they be a veteran or the widow of a veteran or some veteran family member who is qualified for a benefit. In our state, in our 36 counties, we have such a system, and the outreach provided by these folks is commendable. I want to speak to two issues that have been provided for Oregon veterans that are fairly unique to our state, and it's my opportunity to say thank you to this committee and to all the members of the legislature for making these things available. We're using the National Guard and reserves in ways that are unprecedented since World War II. They are making up a large percentage of our frontline force. They are no longer a strategic reserve. They are, in fact, an operational reserve. As such, they are leaving their employment and going into combat for 12, 15, 18 months and then coming back. One of the things we found is that with those people who were small business owners, and I mean small businesses, they were leaving, going to theater, and coming back and trying to pick up the pieces. And the example I'll give you is this. We had an officer serving in the reserve, Army Reserve, who went to war, was gone 15 months, and came back to find that his pest control business was pretty much non-existent. The reasons are simple. If you had been his client and he was gone for 15 months, the pests you were seeking to control didn't go leave anywhere, and so you had to use someone else. So his client base was gone. This body, our legislature, passed the small business repair loan, which is a 0% interest loan that allows us to give these returning small businessmen up to $20,000 to help restart their business. I had a member of my own advisory committee who is a small businessman that said, well, that $20,000 isn't going to help. And I had to disagree by saying, we're looking for sweat equity here. We're looking for people who want to pick themselves up and get started again. So I am very, very pleased to have that tool. I think this body has done a great job in assisting us in helping these returning veterans, and I think we're going to have a number of very good success stories to bring to this body as a result. The second issue, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that I'd like to talk about is the Oregon Veterans Emergency Financial Assistance Program. What we found was that we had many, many young veteran families who were living, as many Oregonians are, payday to payday. We found that if something as simple as the only vehicle they had breaks down, and it's a $300-$500 repair, and they didn't have it, two or three little children to raise, make the monthly rent or house payment, they were having a tough time. If the breadwinner doesn't go to work because the car doesn't work, then the breadwinner gets fired. Now we're looking at welfare. We're looking at some kind of food assistance. We even could look at them losing their dwelling, homelessness issues. So for the cost of a one-time car repair, we kept that veteran employed, bringing home a paycheck, paying their taxes, and maintaining their family. Another example I'd like to give you about this emergency assistance program was a senior veteran from World War II that was not qualified for the kind of dental treatment that he needed through the VA. He had quit going out in public because he wouldn't smile. He wouldn't look at people. He had lost his self-esteem because of how he looked, simply because of his teeth. He lived in the Central Oregon coast. His plight was brought to us both by the American Legion and by the County Veteran Service Officer. We looked at what the need was. Through this fund, we identified a dentist and a denturist who were willing to help. We got the remaining teeth removed. We built for him both an upper and a lower. He then began to eat solid food. His health recovered. He went out in public, and he was able to smile for the first time in years. Had we not had this fund, we would have had to refer him to any number of other agencies who might have been able to piecemeal something together. We deny 2/3 of all the applications for these emergency funds. Only 1/3 of them are actually at the emergency level. The good news is we have the fund. The bad news is it's not enough. We allocate it every quarter of the biennium. The first month of every quarter, that quarter allocation is gone. So we are seeking an increase, a modest one by the standards that I know, of $250,000 for the next biennium. We will, of course, when it comes time to testify about our budget, talk about that in much, much more detail.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
I'll talk to you later. I'd like to volunteer my dentist in Springfield, too.
All right.
That's what he does.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
I'm sure he will, too.
Let me conclude my overview with the last two items, one serving perhaps the youngest of our veterans and the other the most senior. The one serving the youngest of our veterans is our state educational aid program. I will tell you that, of course, there's a federal GI Bill. In fact, there's four different kinds of them, including the newest, which will go into effect in August of 2009, which is called the post-9/11 GI Bill. It's patterned after the original World War II GI Bill, and I'm looking forward to having that impact our state in a very positive way. And one of the things we're doing as part of our governor's recommended budget this year is proposing to put accredited veteran service officers on our university campuses and our community college system so that they can directly impact what's happening. And let me give an example from as close by as I know, other than Willamette University, but our public university system. As an example, a veteran service officer working out of Oregon State University could also service Lynn Benton Community College in Albany and Chemeketa Community College here in Salem and create an ability for those on-campus veterans not only to enroll in the post-9/11 GI Bill quickly and efficiently, but also to counsel with them for claims that they had as a result of their military service or other benefits that are available to them. I believe this program, even though modest in its size, it's starting with only five people to cover the entire state, will pay great dividends to our veterans and their families, and will continue to bring federal dollars, in this case, to our university and community college system. I appreciate very much the state aid program. It may seem modest by some people's view, but the $150 a month up to 36 months for full-time students and the $100 a month for the part-time students is an assistance that in this current economy could put gas in the car, could put groceries in the cupboard, could buy some very expensive books that are needed in order to complete one's education. Having just had a daughter complete her degree at Oregon State University, I can tell you that book prices have changed since I went to school in 1968. They're high. So I really appreciate the ability to be able to do that much for these veterans with state aid. The senior veterans I discussed had to do with the Oregon Veterans Home at the Dalles. I am very, very proud of that home. It has recently, in the past 2.5 years, won two major national awards for quality of care. One of them that was issued to us was only the second veterans home in the nation to receive that recognition. And there's 136 state veterans homes. So that home, while not known to a lot of people, is a quality environment. In fact, we call the Oregon Veterans Home the place where honor lives. And the way we look at that home is we work where they live. This is their home, and we have to respect that fact. So we have veterans, and we have veteran spouses who are in the home. I encourage every member of the committee, if you're passing milepost 187 up there in the gorge, or 87, excuse me, don't go to 187, you're way beyond it. Please take that exit, spend a few minutes. The veterans are always glad to see you, and the staff is glad to see you, and they'd be. You don't even need to make an appointment. You can just show up, and the staff will give you a great tour and show you a facility that we're very, very proud of. It is a 151-bed facility. 25 of those beds are for Alzheimer or other dementia. According to a recent VA survey of our state, Oregon is in need of 800 skilled nursing beds for our veterans. We are, thank goodness again for this legislative body, in the process of siting and building a second Oregon Veterans Home. We are, in fact, coming back to make a report to this committee and to the House committee in April as to the progress. You will meet our construction project manager at that time.
Good.
And we will discuss with you how the siting is going and what the criteria is for those communities in our state that want to make that investment. I can tell you, based on the experience with Wasco County and the City of the Dalles, that is an economic shot in the arm to have that facility within their community. And recently, I'm happy to tell you that the federal government added a community-based outreach clinic to the veteran's home at their expense. That is going to provide veteran services for a tri-county area in the Gorge, and I really appreciate the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs citing that clinic at our home. Another thing that I'm sure you'd all like to see if you get a chance to go there. In the interest of time, Madam Chair, that's a very, very quick overview of our agency. I'll tell you that we're staffed with 93 full-time employees, and we have 190 contract employees at the home serving those 151 beds. I'm very proud of my people. I'm proud of their commitment that they bring to this state, and I will tell you an interesting factoid about our agency. On a per capita basis, we are the most tenured agency in state government, to the extent that when I hold a 20-year ceremony for somebody who has served our agency for 20 years, a lot of our employees look at that person as a rookie. So the good news is we have vast knowledge and experience and dedication. The bad news is when they walk out the door, thank goodness one and two at a time, we lose a huge amount of institutional knowledge, and we have to be careful to do transitional training so that we can replace these very competent people. Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity, members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, I know this won't be your last time before this committee, and in the interest of time, I look forward to the bills that will be coming before us, as well as the information you're going to have to give us. But thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
All
right. Professional staff, Mr. Shook.
All right. With that, I'd like to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Health Fund Board. And I'd like to call Representative Greenlake and Tom Burns up to the dais. Colleagues, all of the Health Fund Board bills are starting in the House. And we're still trying to work out a process where there will be some input from the Senate. But until that process is really set in stone, I felt it would behoove us to know just an overview of the bills that may not even be look like what they look like now, but at least go over House Bill 2009, and then I'm going to have Carol Robinson come up and give you a brief overview of the seven bills that the governor has proposed. With that, Representative Greenlake, thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlake, House District 33, Northwest Portland. Actually, this session, we're referring to it in honor of the sesquicentennial as the home of historic Tualatin County. So I'm very happy to be here with you, and I do hope we find a way to work very closely together as we deal with this very complex issue. I am going to start by talking about House Bill 2009. House Bill 2009 is our attempt to put in, to tee up the Oregon Health Fund Board report for initial discussion. It's the component of the Health Fund Board report that is the first step of putting it in place. And it has four major sections. Tom Burns will walk you through those sections, but let me just say what it is specifically we're trying to do. The Health Fund Board has a set of recommendations, but doesn't, except for the seven bills Ms. Robinson will talk about, doesn't have a specific legislative proposal to put its structure in place. And House Bill 2009, its full weight, does that. It actually, incidentally, that bill is has about 30 pages of real things and about 230 pages of conforming chapters that are simply boilerplate when you change the name of something. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. There are more coming yet before we're done on those. The bill does four basic things. It establishes the Oregon Health Authority, which is an operating department, by moving all the health care functions from other places into a single place so we can streamline our management of the health care system in Oregon by creating this authority. And it brings things out of DHS, virtually all the health care things out of DHS. There's another piece yet coming, I think, bringing the OMIP and other programs into the health authority, and all the public health stuff, all the Medicaid, all the other kinds of health care activities of DHS, and in addition moves the health insurance regulatory authority out of DCBS into the Oregon Health Authority. So a section of the bill does that. Another section of the bill creates a set of responsibilities for the board. It creates the Oregon Health Fund Authority Board and assigns responsibilities, not only authority, but responsibilities to that board to do a variety of things like creating an insurance exchange and a set of other things that the report recommends. The data gathering responsibilities, the Quality Institute, and many of the cost bending kind of features of the health fund board, it puts it in the Oregon Health Authority board. We sort of model that after the Transportation Commission, which with an operating department like ODOT, but a commission that has its own set of responsibilities in addition to the operating department. It makes the recommended changes in Medicaid that the Health Fund Board report. It expands Medicaid to the current waiver authority we have now. So this would add about 100,000 kids and 100,000 adults to the Oregon Health Plan using existing waiver authorities. And the fourth thing it proposes, is a set of provider taxes, and I'll talk about those taxes in a bit. But the broad stroke, and I think the bottom line message, is it proposes about $600 million a year, a biennium, of provider taxes, which would bring $1 billion of federal funds into the state health care system as matching funds to that $600 million. It also has a section on tobacco tax in it for public health, but we've already decided, working with the Revenue Committee, that section will come out of this bill. One of the governor's bills is a tobacco tax bill, and we thought it would be more expeditious to deal, rather than having the tobacco tax discussion in 209 and the transportation package and in the governor's bill, that we'll have that all as one discussion. So the intention is to move the tobacco tax section out of this bill as we start taking amendments. You have two documents in front of you besides House Bill 2009. One is essentially an index of the bill, and Tom will talk about that. And the other is a document created by the Office of Health Policy and Research that cross-hatches the Oregon Health Fund Board report with House Bill 2009 and with the other seven bills that are in the governor's package. So we'll only talk about that in the context of 2009, and my understanding is Ms. Robinson will talk about it in terms of the rest of the package. If it pleases you, I'll ask Tom to do a quick run-through of the bill. Tom was the workforce that created the request to LC for this bill.
And we need a workforce expansion.
Parker.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns. I'm supporting Representative Greenlich on his health policy work. I think the best way to do this is you have the index in front of you, and I'm just going to highlight broad sections of it. If you want to get in specifics about individual sections, I'll be happy to help you understand what our thought process was. To follow the same subject matter that Representative Greenlich laid out, you need to flip pages back and forth. He started with the authority, and so the authority starts in Section 11 and runs through about Sections 27. The operative section for moving the stuff out of the Department of Health and DCBS into the authority is really Section 20. Section 20 is very broadly written. It is designed as almost a placeholder because...
Tell me the two in Section 20, DCBS, and what was the other one?
And all of DHS.
Oh, DHS.
Yeah. And it's really a concept section. All the rest of the bill is the conforming language to implement Section 20. When Representative Greenlich talked about it going on and on and on, that's the conforming language to implement Section 20. Section 20 is the broad concept. So that adds no new duties to any place in state government. It simply rearranges the chairs and the reporting structure. Then, having once rearranged the chairs and created this new authority, we've given extra duties to the authority, and those duties are enumerated in Section 11 through 19, and then Section 21 through 27. And those are all the new duties that the authority will have. They include such things as expanding the role of the OPDP program, establishing the Quality Care Institute, creating a mechanism, the administrative side of the exchange, creates the Quality Care Institute, establishes the fund, the health fund that will handle the revenues and distribute the revenues. Get my other cheat sheet over here so that I can make sure that I'm not missing anything of importance for you.
It's a workforce stuff.
And creates the workforce stuff. Generally, following the board's, the Oregon Health Fund Board's recommendations of broad subject areas, they're more placeholders. And Carol Robinson will talk about the detail behind that in the governance packages, but we say the authority will have a Quality Care Institute. We don't go into detail what the Quality Care Institute is because at the time we crafted this, we didn't have the detail. But the governor's package has the details of the Quality Care Institute, and they can either be separate bills or folded into this vehicle. So that's the authority. Then we have created the board. And as
Senator Cruz.
While we're still in Section 11, Section 11... 2 sub B, it says acquire health care facilities. What do you mean by that?
It just provides after me. For example, we have the state hospital now, which is a health care facility that's owned by the state and will be operating this since we're moving all mental health services into it. It would provide other opportunities similar to that under statutory authority to acquire health care facilities if the authority ends up deeming that that's the best way to provide services for a community.
Yes. So this authority could look at a certain community and decide that a private clinic in that community is not providing the service level necessary and acquire it to get to that service level?
Actually, what was more on my mind that would be to say if you had a failing hospital in the community and the authority deemed that there needed to be hospital services, it could have the authority under whatever statute we gave it to acquire that hospital rather than letting it fail.
Well, I'm assuming there's a lot more details to come as to what's meant by acquire and how you do that, but
there are a lot more details to come, and there's a lot of debate on whether that item should stay there.
That's true.
Senator Morris.
In regard to some of the rural hospitals and clinics that are about to fail, I think that's a good idea.
Well, I mean, we have several district authorities right now that own hospitals, and in most cases, for example, in Newport and in North Lincoln County, contract with the Samaritan Health System. I'm sure Senator Morris is familiar with that. But it was deemed at that point that that was the way to keep hospital services in those communities. And I think this is just an extension of that model, if that's what we need to do. I've always been troubled by the model that you have authority without having responsibility, Senator Cruz, and the purpose of this would be to allow the authority to take responsibility if it was needed to make sure services are provided where they need to be provided.
Okay, just one more while we're still there. Just curious, because you're going to establish Section 11 again, 1 sub B, Quality Care Institute and Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, but as I understood from the exchange subcommittee, that group did not reach consensus, and so something was adopted that was still controversial, and yet you're going to go ahead and move forward with that?
The health fund board suggests creating an insurance exchange.
Right.
This is simply a way of implementing what's in the report. It's our job to debate these things to see if they need to happen, but that this element is the element that that would allow us to put in place what's proposed in the health fund board report.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, just a concern, the fact that the health fund board created committees to do a lot of the heavy lifting in specific areas, and consensus was not reached in all those areas, yet the health fund board went ahead and adopted things that didn't have a consensus report coming back to them. So it's somewhat troubling.
Well, Senator Cruz, you know, we passed 329 and gave the health fund board the responsibility to create a report. They created a committee structure that went with that and then made whatever decisions they made. I was very careful personally to stay out of any of the deliberations of the health fund board. I felt we had given them the job. They've now handed their report over to us, and it's our responsibility to make what we can out of that report. And this is to give us the vehicle to debate these kind of things.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Greenlick, I fully understand that. I'm just expressing some concerns because I stayed at arm's length from the process myself. So, but I did observe it as it went forward. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you might also look at Section 18, which has a lot more detail about the creation of the health exchange.
Okay, thank you.
It goes into much, much further detail. Section 11 just says create it. Section 18 has the detail in it.
But again, it's all language in 18 out of the Health Fund Board report.
Yeah.
We simply translated that language into this.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
The only reference
the authority idea, the purchasing was my own little seed to add to it. I think that's the one place that we deviate a bit from the report.
I'm
sorry, Senator.
Which piece?
The acquiring.
Acquiring.
Acquiring is not listed in the health fund board.
It had your stamp on it,
Madam Chair. Well, you know. You get one or two freebies when you go through all that work.
I don't have any.
I'm sorry, Senator Morissette. I interrupted.
Well, I was just looking. The OPDP would also come under...
Yes.
Yeah. But that's, you don't discuss the changes in the OPDP.
In this place, no.
There's one change, Madam Chair, Senator Morissette. Section 50 has a policy change in it that is recommended by the Health Fund Board to bring all of state and local governments under the OPDP program.
Okay.
You know, and current law says may. This has been changed to a shell.
And we will discuss how that comes about.
Yeah. Here and independently, I suspect.
And independently.
Yeah, the principle that we're trying to,
not, right?
to allow discussion of here is the principle that you can consolidate all the state purchasing power.
I know.
And that it seems to me the most important cost-bending principle that's in the Health Fund Board report
may or may not
is the consolidation of state purchasing power. So that my reading of the report says if we can get all the state purchasing power, Medicaid, PEB, all the other state purchasing power into an exchange where you can pool with that the individual and the group, the small group purchases, that you can then affect the cost because of that pool, and you can certainly affect the cost to individuals and small groups because they can become purchasers that have a much broader purchasing pool.
Agreed.
Madam Chair, continuing, the next subject Representative Greenlee brought up was the board. The board is in sections 1 through 10. 1 through 9, establish the board, the membership, how it's appointed, what its authorities are, and then section 10 details all the individual authorities to be the policymaking body, to implement programs, to develop healthcare standards for quality standards, establish cost control mechanisms. Section 10 is really the operative section of what the board is going to be charged with doing.
Is there teeth with this? It's given the authority. It actually really could establish rates or control rates.
The way it's written, it has the authority to add rules to its own duties, which I presume would allow it to establish rates.
But most of the authority goes with the responsibility to produce a plan for the key issues to the 2009 2011 legislature. So it's not if the bill is passed, required to produce plans for a variety of things and bring them to us in the 2011 session.
Thank you.
Okay, the next subject is the Medicaid program expansion. That is over in sections 124 through 127.
We hid those from you, so it's like a little harder to find.
I didn't write it. Talk to counsel about the order. I just read it on a snowy day, and I was trapped. So sections, like I said, those are the expansion. It talks about expanding the number of kids to the waiver level of 185%, the number of adults to 185%. There is
to 100%.
To 100%. There is some language in here that references 300. We're not quite sure where the 300 came from. The intent was that up to 185 would be fully covered under the Medicaid program, and then as the board suggests that some sort of sliding scale for 185 to 300, the language in the bill does not put the word sliding scale in, so that's I didn't write it. Lawyers wrote it.
As you can imagine, this was a pretty complicated bill to get written, and LC worked admirably on this, and there are some things that showed up that wasn't in the recommendation. Incidentally, the notion for children would be probably the 200%. We have 185% now, and we have a sort of semi-waiver that says we'll express waiver approval of the 200% if you have the money to do it. So we're thinking that most of the kids will come in if we push it to 200%. The adults is to 100%. There was the sort of notion in the report, and it came out a little differently in the bill, and we obviously need to clean it up, that there'd be the kind of FEOP expansion beyond 200% for kids and perhaps beyond 100% for adults, but that needs to be clarified.
Yes, Senator.
Yeah, Mitch, do you have a ballpark figure of how many additional adults that would be?
No.
Okay.
But the primary focus of the bill is, I hope to get it out of our committee, would be kids to 200%, adults to 100%. And the calculations that we're trying to create now, working with LFO and LRO and the hospitals and the governor's group, is based on those kinds of numbers. Kids to 200%, adults to 100%.
Senator Morissette?
well, the CHIP program that is being expanded at the federal level would help if we could match, put up the match. That's going to be a problem.
I think the numbers we've been trying to do now would do it without CHIP. I mean, without an expansion of CHIP, with the existing CHIP. If CHIP absolutely gets expanded, it would make those numbers even better. And we're all hoping, of course, that
it'll be interesting when you attach a dollar amount to this.
But that's Madam Chair, that's it. Wouldn't the expansion of CHIP make it almost more advantageous for us not to go above 180? Because then they're not Medicaid eligible, and they would qualify for CHIP then.
Well, SCHIP has a 2575.
I know that. That's why that's
so
better than
Medicaid.
We should
expand. Yeah, obviously, if it gets expanded, you know, when we wrote this, it was dead. The expansion was dead. If it expands, it'll clearly make it easier to do the job with less less money.
But as I understand it, if they're Medicaid eligible, their Medicaid clients, not CHIP, is...
We have people in the back room shaking their heads.
Yeah,
this may be more detail than we need.
Which way are they shaking them? So. This way or that way?
A long way from there.
Yeah. Madam Chair, continuing, Section 128 contains a $100 million increase in reimbursement rate to providers, undefined.
Which section?
128.
We intend as a part of this expansion, as a part of the you're hearing all kinds of things in the building that aren't making a lot of sense, including a lot of fancy models that aren't making a lot of sense. But the underlying assumption that we have is that the reimbursement rates will be, there'll be money to increase the reimbursement rates, and the OHP standard, the benefit standard for the OHP standard, will become basically OHP plus, so that this will both provide funds in the... Our intention is to design the provider tax that will provide enough money to bring enough federal money into the population so that providers will be reimbursed at a higher rate than they are now, and the benefit package for the new people will be the OHP plus basically the OSP plus benefit package rather than the OSP standard. And that's the assumptions. Most of the models don't increase reimbursement and they don't change the benefit package, and the structure of 2009 intends to have both of those pieces as a part of the provider tax. Let me just comment on the provider tax for a moment. The bill has blank numbers, but it proposes a blank percent tax on hospital revenues, and it proposes a blank percent tax on gross insurance company revenues, third-party administrators, and pharmacy benefit managers. And the objective of that tax is to create enough extra revenue into the healthcare system so that on average, the people paying the tax will essentially break even on average after a transition period. There's no question there's going to be a transition period from where we are now to where we've achieved the expansions of Medicaid. But our intention is to craft this in such a way, and we're working closely with the revenue committees, and as Senator Monis Anderson knows, with a broad group from the House and the Senate to try and talk about this. Our intention, let's talk about the hospital tax per se. Right now, the hospital tax, the hospitals put in a dollar, the feds put in $1.60, and the whole $2.60 goes back to the hospitals. That's not what we're proposing here, but what we are proposing on average is that at least when the hospitals as a class put in a dollar and we get $1.60 back, the hospitals will at least get back their dollar. The $1.60 will go to support the system in general. So that while there will likely be winners and losers, say, from the hospital category, if we craft it correctly, on average, hospitals will all come out even. The hospitals that currently serve a higher proportion of Medicaid and a higher proportion of uncompensated care will come out winners in that equation. The hospitals that currently serve a lower proportion of Medicaid and a lower proportion of uncompensated care, if we balance it right, will come out losers. So you're going to be hearing, and incidentally, we're talking only about A and B, about DRG hospitals. So all the A and B hospitals will automatically come out better because there will be more compensation for them for Medicaid patients, and there will be fewer uncompensated cases without Medicaid. So we're trying to balance it, if we get this right, in the DRG hospitals, so they're going to come out on average even. Ultimately, the same thing should be true of the insurance companies. Insurance companies are right now are buying hospital care for their covered lives at 128% of cost, because the Medicaid folks and the uncompensated care are being cost shifted onto the insurance companies. With a 1.5% or 1% or whatever that number turns out to be, our models will aim, after we get over the transition period, which is probably a couple of years where there'll be some variation, is that they will at least break even in terms of their tax, so that the reduction of uncompensated care will reduce the price of hospital, or the price increase at least, of hospital care that they're buying now. And that's the model we're aiming at. Now, you're going to hear people say this pencils out to us, it doesn't pencil out to us. And our objective is to get the pencil out as an industry and then figure out how to deal with the fact that there are winners in and losers in that model.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Representative, for this presentation. What's the anticipation of the for-profit systems, the physician-driven ASCs, the for-profit hospital? Where do they fall into this provider?
The large for-profit hospitals fall under this. At the moment, the Health Fund Board report didn't propose adding things like ambulatory surgery centers and imaging centers. I think we're going to have to take that into consideration, because I suspect they ought to be a part of this equation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
just trying to get my hands around this. The problem with the current provider tax is it's a net sum game for providers that are putting into the system. And I guess I'm still wondering at this point where CMS is going to come down, if we are taxing, we are doing a medical tax to fund a medical system, and the components that are paying the tax are being held harmless in it.
Well, they're being more than held harmless in the current model.
I understand that. I understand They're more than held harmless now. Have we got a read from CMS on this yet? I mean, I think it's still a significant ask what we're asking here.
We think it follows the current model. What we know is the current model we have, A, sunsets here, and we have to figure out what to do with it, and B, we know the MCO tax, the medical care organization tax, in its current form, does not conform to CMS. So their requirements are that it, at least on the insurance side, at least cover all managed care programs. By that, we're believing that it could mean all health insurance plans. I think it conforms, but ultimately we're going to have to, I don't think we're going to have an advanced read on this, Senator Cruz. I think it's something we're going to have to look at the regulations, look at our legislative councils, and get some read on it. But I've not heard a lot of problems with the hospital tax. I've not heard a lot of people that have a problem in terms of CMS approval of the hospital taxes we're proposing it here.
Okay, I don't know.
I do know
when we did the last provider tax, we did it with the assumption that it was going to be okay, and then it turned out that it wasn't quite so much. So,
no, but it was mostly okay.
Huh?
It was mostly okay.
It was mostly okay, but even if it wasn't sunsetting, they weren't going to honor it anymore. So it'd be nice if we had some sort of a read from CMS on...
Maybe I could offer.
Senator Morissette. Okay. Is this following up on his?
Following up on Jeff.
I think it's. Who knows what the new administration is going to do and what the new directors are going to do? And I think that there should be a two-way communication here. That you should be talking with our congressional delegation and the new Secretary of Health and Human Services and so on, because we don't know what's going to happen.
Well, the only rumor of any name I've heard for CMS director, and it's an old rumor, was that Howard Dean was a name that was floated, but it would be interesting to see who the new director is, and I haven't heard a recent rumor.
Okay.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make a couple comments and probably get to the basis of what our concerns were with the provider tax before. The key phrase of defining the provider taxes is they must be broad-based, and that's the key phrase. And how you interpret that phrase is what's important. As far as the provider tax for hospitals, broad-based means what we're doing. They are broad-based, and exempting the A's and B's has never been a question. The part that was there before was broad-based could be interpreted under old regulations, which an act of Congress did change, and we expected that change, that broad-based was all Medicaid MCOs. And the intent, I believe, of the law originally was all managed care plans, not just Medicaid ones. And what we had happen when we put the tax in place was many of the companies that had mixed plans, commercial and Medicaid plans, quickly cut out their commercial plans, separate them so they wouldn't be subject to the tax. We know when expected that was not going to fly very long. Congress changed the regulations as we expected, and now we know that we have to make this much more broad base, which has some political ramifications to it, which we're all aware of. So now it does need to be broad based. That was the only wrinkle in this thing, and many of us felt that originally allowing insurers to cut out the commercial market was probably not appropriate and didn't fulfill at least the spirit of the law. That clearly has to be fixed if we're going to maintain that part of the tax. The other thing I'd like to comment to, and I came a little late, and I apologize for being gone. I have two hats around here. One's a doctor hat, so I wear my doctor hat for a couple minutes there. So I apologize for being gone. We've had large discussions with the hospitals and the other insurers about this, and one of the issues I keep coming back to for them, if you don't accept this tax in some way, shape, or form, knowing there's not enough general fund money, knowing there's not going to be a payroll tax to support this kind of a program, what is your plan? You're going to have an increasing cost in your hospital if we don't get more people insured, get them into primary and preventative care, keep them out of your ERs and out of your hospitals. And that'll be uncompensated care. If you look at the late 1990s and early 2000s, as the standard population diminished, the amount of care going into the hospitals dramatically increased that was uncompensated, and premiums for commercial carriers went up. And you can plot those two, and I can show this to you at a later time, and they line up with each other perfectly. Now, there are other things involved, lack of managed care and some other things, but essentially what we did was drove up commercial premiums, drove up hospital costs by not having these people insured, and that's what we're trying to get to here. Can you prove penny for penny, dollar for dollar, this money comes back to a hospital or to an insurance carrier? Really difficult to do. It'll probably take a couple years for it to work its way through the market. But if you do nothing, where are we going to be? Hospitals right now are already in the red, some of them are close to being in the red. A big piece of that is uninsured care. Some of it is some efficiencies they need to get. Some of it is their profit centers being pulled out into ambulatory care centers. A lot of other issues involved here. But if you do nothing, I can guarantee you that insurance premiums will become unattainable for many, many people in the state. The uninsured will go up, especially in the face of the recession, and hospitals ultimately and insurance carriers will be in worse shape. This is something that really is in their best interest in the long run. Getting it past them in a short run is the difficulty. And they like to see different mechanisms for doing it. But politically, we can't do that right now.
Yeah. Senator Morse?
Yeah. In addition, I think the one element that I think you left out, Senator, was the undercompensated care.
Yes.
It's a major
yes.
portion
yes.
of provider
yes.
Cost benefit or revenue structures. And I'm not sure how you could assess that tax and be revenue neutral for that undercompensated care, how that formula works.
We need to look at that. I believe this formula absolutely requires moving Medicaid reimbursements in the hospitals at least to the Medicare level. That would be from something like 68% of cost to 87% of cost. And we need to have money in that formula to do that. I mean, that seems to me a vital thing. So if you then take your excuse me, your existing Medicaid population and bump up the revenue on that by 20% roughly, and also take people out of the uncompensated component and put it into that 87% from 0% of cost to 87% of cost, then I think you have a formula that actually works. And I think you'll see some models, but I think the models that do that kind of change actually works. The other thing, you'll see a Milliman study that at last count was completely flawed. The assumptions are wrong. The data was wrong. They claim they've improved it. But the interesting thing about that is even in that flawed study, there was one model that said, what if you don't do anything but you lose 10,000 insured lives? And that model increased health insurance premiums by 3.6%. That's doing nothing. Now, that's an underestimate of what they're going to lose, given that we're now at 9% unemployment rate and moving. I believe the estimate would be that if we do nothing, health insurance rates will increase by 5 or 6% just on the basis of the uninsured population, because there's no such thing as free care. It's being paid for now by the insurers.
Further questions?
Madam Chair, yes. I do have, and we've spent time wisely looking at an overview. My question deals with process. This is an extremely complicated document and concepts. How do we interface in a bicameral way so that this has both looks in moving this thing through? Maybe discuss that for just briefly.
We've been brainstorming and trying to brainstorm a little bit with President Courtney's office. And at this point in time, President Courtney has established an ongoing meeting. The date has not really been honed down yet.
From today, I think.
Yeah, but it conflicts with this committee meeting.
Oh.
It's always evenings.
I know.
And then the other issue is he does meet Friday afternoons. His committee meets Friday afternoons from 3 to 5. And so we're just sort of trying to figure out what would be best. And that's why I wanted to bring this before the committee today. And I'm glad you raised the issue. Senator Bates?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually bringing up the same issue. I wasn't sure if it was appropriate to do it publicly at this point, but I'm going to anyway. The health fund board is a result of 329, and 329 was a result of a two-year interim work done, and 329 evolved from the last session. We had to meet two nights a week. They were long. They were detailed. Members of this committee were there and all helped put 329 together. None of us agree with every part of 329. I believe that what we're looking at here is the most important thing this committee is going to work on in this session, without a doubt. And I would hope that we could set up a process where both committees met together, probably two nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Thursday, some way of working that out. This is going to take time. This is going to be a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to work this out, a lot of public testimony, a lot of very careful thought. What I don't want to see is a bill come out of the House, comes to us, we work it and then send it back, and we're bouncing a bill back and forth. The next thing we know, it's June 30th, and we've not got anything done. I think we need to do this together right from the get-go. You guys have made a wonderful start in this, and I really appreciate the hard work you've done and the committee work you've done and the work in the interim. It really gives us a framework to get started on, but we need more look at, and we need more time with it. And so I would strongly recommend that we set aside two nights a week during the week and start this process. It'll be up to leadership to make that decision.
Yeah, but first let me say another piece of this discussion, which is this is obviously health care policy, revenue, and ways and means. And we've been trying to work out a process on both sides where we can have these considerations taking place. I think the current plan would be to keep it in the policy committee until we've had as much worked out as we possibly can so that it doesn't start over when it moves to revenue. And I hope we're going to be able to do that. So it would be very useful, at least on the House side, if we can have the discussions with revenue and ways and means and achieve a compromise, an agreement that we can all live with. I don't know what your schedule is, but we meet from 3 to 5 on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I think if there's any way that we could meet jointly in that time period, I'd be happy to put both Monday and Wednesday, say, on a regular basis, into a joint committee on Monday and Wednesday, 3 to 5, and then use Friday for the rest of our business. We also do intend to do two things. We intend to have at least a couple of night sessions for public testimony, because there's going to be a lot of public testimony, and if we can have a couple of those. And we're also now proposing a session early in February in Southern Oregon, probably in Grants Pass, where we can get public testimony from the folks in the South to help that. But if 3 to 5 works, we could meet jointly.
Monday and Wednesday, I'm on another committee from 3 to 5.
So how about Friday from 3 to 5?
I can't be there on Fridays 3 to 5 for the next 4 weeks, 5 weeks.
But the rest of us could be.
Either by phone at that time?
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
But let's not get into the details right now. I think the options are out on the table, and that's what I felt was most important. We need to work with leadership on setting up a time frame and working with the individuals on the committee to make sure, what would work out best for them. So with that, I think that let's move on, if that's all right, and have Carol Robinson come on up and just give a brief overview of this.
You do have the document in front of you which outlines the pieces that are 209 and the pieces that are the other bills that was produced.
Carol was going to give us that, yes.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
And thank you, because this conversation obviously needs to happen. We've got to work bicamerally as far as
we're
concerned.
And also, don't believe everything you hear in the back room. Okay. I know this will be a surprise to you, but it's not always totally accurate.
Thanks, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, sir.
Very much. So Dr. Smith is also going to come up. Carol let me know that she did have a handout that would help us in knowing what was the 7 bills from the governor and how that compared with 2009.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Carol Robinson, Interim Executive Director of the Alp Fund Board. With me, Dr. Janine Smith, who's the Administrator of Oregon Health Policy Research. Because we don't have very much time left, I will defer to you, Madam Chair, on how you would like us to give you this overview.
I told the committee that as long as we didn't have session, that we would go as long as we could.
Okay, great.
So
Thank you very much.
Information is very important.
I appreciate that, this opportunity. And I appreciate your interest in the work of the Oregon Health Fund Board. And we view this as a kind of a handing off of the baton, in the sense that great work was developed in the plan from the Oregon Health Fund Board that needs legislation and structure to it. We are very grateful to Representative Greenlick and Tom Burns for their development of an infrastructure, and we view House Bill 2009 as really an infrastructure piece. And to support that infrastructure, underneath the infrastructure, we see the need for specific movement in the following areas that will help begin to contain costs in healthcare escalation, improve quality and transparency that will lead the state to making better decisions and drive the market as well. So you have the crosswalk that lays out the action steps from the Oregon Health Fund Board's recommendations with 2009 and the other bills that were developed on behalf of DHS and the governor. And if I could just give you a short overview, and Dr. Smith would chime in at any point in helping to give you the intent and plan within those bills. The idea that cost containment or the bending of the cost curve is essential, hand in glove, hand in hand with any kind of health coverage expansion, is the building blocks, the underpinnings of the Health Fund Board's plan. And I think that we view this as a two-track approach, but both rails of that track are equally important. So we, the board strongly supported the use of a provider tax to fund expansion, thinks that strongly backs the need for expanding coverage to organs, kids, and all of the uninsured children in the state, as well as one-third of the poorest and most vulnerable adults without insurance currently, and supports the use of a tobacco tax to fund public health programs as well. The other rail of that are the 7 cost containment bills that begin the work of a more thoughtful and organized approach to providing health care in our state, to purchasing health care, and to driving good health decisions by the population. So we'll start with House Bill 2128, which is really a transparency and organizational bill that will set up an all-payer, all-claims data collection program, allowing the state to begin to understand healthcare utilization and costs across the state. And we believe that this will show us trends that will allow the state to make better decisions. And we think that, as Representative Greenlick mentioned, that the 20% of the all healthcare purchases are made by the state of Oregon, so that understanding the utilization trends across the state with every single claim in the database, what those are, how much the charges are for, will begin to really show us utilization. We also believe that the committees that are recommended for development in House Bill 2128 are essential to beginning this strategically incremental approach to lowering costs. So there are committees that would impact tort reform, look at delivery system and primary care revitalization, and make recommendations on the creation and development of a health insurance exchange that would cover all uninsured individuals. Go ahead.
Oh. Janine Smith, Office of Health Policy. To note, to meet the requirements of having to fit with the executive branch deadlines, 2128 just talks about continuing the Health Fund Board versus House Bill 2009 has a little bit more intricate structure. The concept of a health authority hadn't been fully developed by the board as of the deadlines in which we had to submit these legislative concepts that now are bills. So that's why you're not seeing as full of force. The board is very, and outlines in its report, this more broader health authority concept as similar to Representative Greenlick's House Bill 2009, but just as a placeholder we had put. The reality is you need some entity to take this work. We've 14 months, 110 public meetings, over 100 volunteers, 2,000 input from Oregonians. We don't want this report to just sit on a shelf. We feel that there's got to be something that carries all these recommendations forwards and stepwise moves them forward. So,
Henry Morissette.
Okay, we're going to hear these bills this session. We're going to pass perhaps these bills this session. There's a fiscal attached to them. Do you anticipate that these bills will be implemented this session?
Senator Morissette and Chair Mona Sanderson, I would hope that they would be implemented as expediently as possible.
Well, okay. Are they in the governor's budget? Is it $5
million? Yes, there's $5 million.
Okay, that's what the $5 million is for, is to implement.
So these seven bills are encompassed inside the governor's recommended budget for an approximate total of $5 million.
Okay.
They're small first steps, realizing the strict budget times that we're under at this point.
Okay.
Would love to have made them larger, but had to scale back based on the economy.
Hey, Senator Morissette, Chair Mona Sanderson, there is also a 2.7 approximate federal match on that $5 million that we would get. So it's a little bit more money to begin the work, and I think the board feels that that while House Bill 2009 again provides that infrastructure, that without the actual dollars put forward by the governor's recommended budget, we worry that that we couldn't move forward the work. And so these are essential piece of implementing the plan.
One more question, please. Senator Greenlick, or Representative Greenlick's bill, if that should move, would that, okay, the conflict potentially between the two bills would, are they mutually exclusive, parts of them?
Senator Morissette, Chair Mona Sanderson, Committee, I would say that that's a decision that the legislature, and in your wisdom, will have to really consider. I don't believe so. I think that with proper kind of evaluation and however there could be amendments that would make this into, you know, one health reform bill package. Maybe the infrastructure is one package, and delivery system is another design that you might want to approach. But I think that in your wisdom, that's your imprint, that the legislature can decide.
Are we going to have enough time to do that?
I hope you do have time, and I hope that we can provide you with all of the support and resources to be able to get that done.
Thank you.
Really quickly running through the other six bills, House Bill 2129 is our clinical improvement assessment. And the essential piece of this is that this is where we begin to create a set of evidence-based clinical guidelines. This will improve the state's access and application to comparative effectiveness research. An example of that is just in drug purchasing, a generic versus a more expensive name brand drug. And so setting those standards begins to drive the state's purchasing and ultimately, hopefully, set standards that the commercial market will follow. House Bill 2131 is our Integrated Health Homes and Healthy Communities Bill. And what that complicated name really means is driving health behavior back into a primary care team setting where you integrate physical health with behavioral and mental health issues, and oral health included with that. There is a tremendous body of research across the country and within our own state that shows better health outcomes, lower incidence of serious reactions to chronic disease when people's health is treated at the primary care level. So House Bill 2131 would lead to common standards in a health integrated health home and create quality outcome measurements so that we could begin to set up some models that hopefully would be broadened in the future. House Bill 2132 is the end of life care. It's called the PULSED Registry. And it's meant to be supportive of the end of life.
This is the physician's ordered life sustaining treatment registry. So this is not to be confused with the advanced directives, which everyone can do with their family and decide what they want to have. What this is, a physician's order that an emergency technician can actually act upon. So if you're called to my mother's home and she's called and she's out of it and she can't tell them what she wants, the pulse, they could call up through the registry, and it's they're actually doing a pilot right now through the Center for Ethics, Dr. Susan Toll's work right now, to test this out, make sure it's as confidential and as reliable as possible, so that that EMT could call up and get, yes, this woman wants to be resuscitated, or no, she doesn't. And so it's really to make this, it's a part of a streamlining and a system improvement of the delivery system, so that there's not unnecessary care done that's against the wishes of that patient. So it addresses some of the concerns and issues that were raised in the 329 discussions and interim work. And I think Senator Betsy Johnson is also interested in having a sort of a companion bill, and so which one actually, they're essentially the same bill.
House Bill 2142 is our electronic health record adoption bill, which would set up an oversight council on representing a wide group of stakeholders that would be responsible for setting the goals to related to health information technology and the interoperability of health electronic health records. We are also working with our congressional delegation to build the case for Oregon's being a recipient of stimulus money around electronic health records. That's something that we understand President Obama is very interested in being part of an economic stimulus package. We think that this particular bill would help position Oregon in a way of being able to utilize those funds most effectively. So we're excited about that bill. And House Bill 21...
Madam Chair, could I ask a question on that?
Sure.
Electronic records is something near and dear to my heart. In fact, I think Senator Morissette's committee is going to go down for a field hearing in Roseburg to look at the DSIPA system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are we looking... the Department of Ed's got a pretty nice model. Are we looking at that model for the data warehouses, for translation, that sort of thing?
Senator Cruz, Chairman Anderson, what this really does is help provide some guidance to small groups of physicians or other healthcare providers as to what kind of system should they invest in into their own clinics, and how can, you know, there's a huge number of vendors out there, how do they pick and choose? So it builds on the work of the governors by executive order this last year, started a health information infrastructure advisory council, and these recommendations were came from that to the health fund board to set up a sort of a purchasing collaborative, so to speak, so we could help to lower the costs for physicians, and also continue to look at what standards those should have so they can start to communicate with each other. If there's a federal stimulus dollars or other dollars that could come in, then you could actually target grants or assistance to providers to help get their electronic health records up, realizing that we actually as a state are pretty well in terms of people having, because of our large groups of organized physicians, we have a lot of kind of a higher adoption of this than some other states. But the systems don't talk to each other. So it starts to go down the road of what can we do to stimulate them, not only to purchase a system if you're in a very small town in halfway, and also still be able to communicate with the hospital in Bend to get that patient's information.
Yeah, follow up. I guess my point is when we looked at the information system we needed in education specifically to deal with all the data No Child requires, was rather than try to get everybody to conform to one system, let's allow them to operate systems that they have that are working and just set up a network at the state level so that information can be translated and exchanged. And
And Senator Cruz, Chair Monis Anderson, there are some efforts around that. The Medicaid agency right now is working on a health record bank to try to allow some connectivity in terms of across records. The state was a beneficiary of the FCC grant to lay some cable between a lot of the healthcare facilities. So I think we're starting down the road of trying to be better connected and trying to do it in the most cost-effective, efficient way, realizing that small solo practitioners are at a challenge for this. Senator Morissette.
Well, have you looked at what's going on in Oregon currently, for instance, in Roseburg? You're aware of some of those systems.
Senator Morissette and Chair Monis Anderson, we absolutely are working with some of the good work that's happening in, for example, some of the managed care organizations like DSIPA.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I would say that OCHIN has been doing some work across the state with a number of the managed care groups and safety net clinics. I think that we need to build on the good work that's being done and look
very
to
good
successes, absolutely.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Bates.
A couple quick comments to follow up on this. From a physician who hasn't got an electronic medical record, which is starting in our office July.
Naughty, naughty.
But it's starting July 1st. We've signed up, so we're going to be doing it. And, you know, one of the offshoots of the very unique system we have in Medicaid in the state, which is organizations, MRIPA, ELIPA, and others, is they have gotten together and recognized the need for electronic medical records, and it's made it an affordable situation for individual mm-hmm. offices and large groups. Roseburg's a good example. Grants Pass, Medford's a good example. We're doing exactly the same thing there. A system that used to cost an individual practitioner $40,000 or $50,000 and was completely out of their reach, plus a monthly fee of $1,000 per physician, is now available for $500 per physician with no upfront cost. And the IPAs have put together the programs and figured out which is best for that group in that area.
Right.
Grants Pass and the Asante system will all be on the same electronic medical records between hospital and physicians within the next 6 months. Medford will be following. There will be some groups that are not on that system, but we've got a method for making them talk to each other. And this is going to sweep the state, I think. And I think my understanding is Oregon is one of the leading, if not the leading, state in electronic medical records as far as penetration.
Right.
We're at about 30-40% somewhere in there.
Higher than that, I think.
Are we higher than that now?
Nine.
And
really?
And the funny thing is, as we're recruiting these new young physicians coming in, they are telling us, if you haven't got an electronic medical record system, I'm not interested in joining your practice. And for us old fogies can hardly run an iPhone, it's a real shock, okay? But they are so used to this in their training, and they've grown up with this, that they don't want anything but this. And they're right. The errors go down, mm-hmm. ultimately efficiency goes up, and you get better patient care. And it's a change. But it's happening rather rapidly now. It's really picking up steam, and the things that are going on in Roseburg are really a great example of what a community can do.
Continue.
Thank you. I noticed that I skipped over House Bill 2130, which is an important bill on transparency, and I wanted to jump back to that real quick. This 2130 increases transparency in healthcare reporting. How we can actually improve the monitoring of health insurance company finances. An example of this would be if the administrative cost portion of a rate increase exceeds the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, a company would have to justify in order to have it approved. And there's standards within House Bill 2130 that would create reporting and hopefully bring us to more efficient use of common claims forms as well. House Bill 2143 is the Healthcare Workforce Initiative, and very similar to Senator Morse's bill with a different funding mechanism. What we know...
You don't have this bill number of Senator Morse's.
Senate Bill 11, is that?
11.
I think
yeah.
It is.
Thank
Senator
you.
Morse's bill.
Okay.
So House Bill 2143 and Senate Bill 11, I think, would both look at being able to understand, first of all, our workforce. We know that workforce is going to be a very, very significant issue to be able to meet our goals of improving primary care, of meet our needs as an aging population. And while the Oregon Center for Nursing and the ONA have done an excellent job around understanding the nursing workforce, we don't have the ability right now at the state level to really understand what our workforce needs will be, and this would be a first step in being able to do that. You want to talk a little bit more about that?
This would just allow us to have a better feel of what's the real capacity. I mean, even in an emergency situation, you know, we've tried to do sort of a surge capacity of just the northwest section of Oregon in our office, asked for by some of the counties, and it's really hard to know. You know, I look like I'm practicing full-time on the rolls of the Board of Medical Examiners when I'm only actually in the clinic about a half a day a week. So trying to understand where everyone works and how many hours, and if you tie it to licensing, it's more reliable. If we try to do a survey, it's one, expensive, and two, response rates aren't great. So really understanding, I mean, we had to actually call leasing offices to figure out where people's actual practices were, because a lot of times your mailing address is your home address or your primary one clinic, but you go to four other places half the week. So it really would get us better information. So we could target when there's more dollars available, and ideally, hopefully, maybe some federal dollars available to stimulate the workforce to meet the needs as we move forward towards broader universal approaches to coverage.
I'd like to call your attention to a policy brief that you've been given that was created from OHPR for the Oregon Health Fund Board's work. Specific to the cost containment actions within these bills, you can see potential savings in the short run with 3-year savings of hundreds of millions of dollars. And when you move that out in the 10-year spectrum, that there are billions of dollars to be saved by making these first steps, taking the first steps of the Oregon Health Fund Board's plan. And I think that when we look at what the initial investment to begin taking these steps will be, even within a difficult economic climate, you can see that this is an investment that will, I think, bring big, very, very big rewards for the state, driving utilization in different ways, driving practitioner, provider care in different ways, helping us to make better decisions, both as a state and on the commercial side as well. And so I encourage you to take a look at that policy brief and keep that kind of close in hand as you consider these. I'd be glad to answer any other questions you might have or come back at any time during the committee's work to share more information on specifics within the larger documents. I will say that this will be put in your mailbox within the next 24 hours from the Health Fund Board, and along with that is a federal laws report that looks with the same cover, a little bit skinnier, and we felt that the board felt that it was very important to, and as did Senate Bill 329, to be able to work within the federal requirements and guidelines that I heard you discussing with Representative Greenlick. And so being able to utilize our federal delegation hopefully as effectively as possible, keep our reimbursement rates or increase them and work as effectively as we can with the federal government as well, because that's such an important piece to the payment reform that will be needed to drive this system. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, have we had first readings on these bills?
Senator Morissette and Chair Monis Anderson, no, not at this time.
On the House side.
Excuse me. These have had first readings on the House side. They're in the process on the House side, correct?
In the process.
They're in the process on the House side, and they the things that needed to be done in order to implement the governor's recommended budget item.
Okay, so these are available. They're out.
They're in play.
Yeah. They are. In fact, yes. And I have copies of all the bills. We do too.
Yeah.
The House gives us copies of their bills. It's so nice.
So thank you very much,
Carol,
Dr. Smith. Colleagues, I know we're running late, but I know that we will be having evening meetings if we're not going, and as long as we don't have session, I would rather continue longer during this time, and so just be prepared that if we're going over, as long as we don't have session, we will be doing that on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other business? With that, we're adjourned.
I was
talking to Courtney first.
I was good.